I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The world is obsessed with measurement, especially it seems when it comes to cities. We have the best city for lovers, the best city for families, the healthiest city for women and men. Now the Conference Board of Canada has introduced its own ranking of Canadian cities and compared their performance with key cities in the U.S. Today we'll talk to the man who led that study, Mario Lefebvre. Also with us is Dr. Bridget Jones, who has put together a remarkably broad and effective coalition of elected officials, hunters, farmers, and traffic officials in Nashville and Middle Tennessee for smart growth and sustainability. That's today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The Conference Board of Canada has a new study out on benchmarking the attractiveness of Canada's cities in the metropolitan areas they anchor. It's called City Magnets, and the man who put it together is Mario Lefebvre. What assumptions did you make about what makes a city attractive to people?
Well, it was a whole series of either readings from the literature or trying to get data from migration and seeing what are the factors that people seem to be factoring in when they move from one location to the next, realizing that, yes, economy still plays a big role, but opposite to what people may think, it's not just people go where the jobs are anymore. There's more to it than that. Mobile population do their homework, and the internet probably helps a lot in terms of mobile population now being able to dig into statistics regarding crime and healthcare systems and the number of doctors that they will find in this or in this one location. So they can really do their homework. They put it all together. Yes, of course, getting an interesting job remains a key aspect. So, of course, the economy domain, if I may call it that, still plays a big role into the decision process of people. But there's more to it than that, and I think this study is showing that, yes, while economy still matters, other domains are still playing a very critical role.
Did you base your assumptions on any conversations or research directly with mobile populations?
We didn't talk to actual people that have moved, but when you take, for example, Statistics Canada's census, which comes out every 5 years, you get to learn quite a bit about migration movements and people going from one place to another, and sometimes there are also questions related to why people have moved, and so and there's also some literature about this, and there's also the work that Richard Florida has put together over the past few years on what makes people select one city over another. So we tried to put all of this together, but no, we didn't make any survey, and in fact, we wanted to stay away from survey. This was a first issue. It's the first ever, I think, attempt at measuring attractiveness to people of cities. So we wanted to stick to official statistics, those produced by Statistics Canada, and on the housing front, those produced by the Canadian Housing Corporation. So we really wanted to make sure, because survey data, yes, I know that a lot of people are using it. I'm not saying it's necessarily bad. But when you survey people that live in different places and the cities that are involved into this study are very different from one another, it's easy to lose people in terms of interpretation of questions, and what people may see as blue may be black or red in another area. So we stayed away from survey data, sticking to official statistics. And what is really great, I think, about this study is that, opposite to several other benchmarking initiatives that I've seen, is that we can put our results to the test. We think we've measured attractiveness to people. Good. We've put a ranking of attractiveness to people, and we've challenged that ranking by comparing it to the actual migration number. Did we really measure attractiveness to people? The correlation that we're putting together in the end is proving to us that we have really measured what we thought we were trying to measure.
Who are the most mobile people in Canada?
This is not what we're trying to address. We're not trying to see if it's university graduates or undergrad that are more mobile than others. This study has really had one focus only. It was to see which city was more attractive to people than other ones. We should talk about why we thought it is so important to know where we stand in terms of attractiveness to people. What triggered that study was the 2006 census that was produced by Statistics Canada, in which you will find that one of the conclusions is that in a not so far distant future, all of Canada's population growth will be attributable to immigration. So to us, that triggered the idea that if a city is not able to attract immigrant, it can look forward to a very bleak population growth moving forward. And soft or modest, call it what you want, population growth will turn into soft economic growth. Why? Because population growth is what dictates something like your housing requirement. So it tells you a lot about what the construction industry will do moving forward. Population growth is also what is also the indicator that you use in order to know how many people you will have inside your shopping malls. And consumption remains a big variable when you put together an economic forecast for be it a country, a province, or a city. So at the end of the day, having a soft population outlook does not bode well for the economy as a whole of that given area. So that is why we thought we should really bite the bullet, take a look into attractiveness to people, not just to rank cities. And I'm hoping that this study will not be remembered for just a ranking of cities, but to give cities a set of indicators to look at. What are the things they should be working on? Where are they doing well? Where are they maybe not so doing well? And try and concentrate their efforts in trying to improve on this, because their future prosperity is at stake.
I'm curious if all the population growth in Canada will come from immigrants, and that certainly makes a lot of sense. If that is the case, I'm curious if you look specifically at what is attractive to Canada's immigrants?
Well, first and foremost, an international migrant is not always an international migrant. And in fact, when you look at the migration numbers in Canada, what you see is that someone that came over from another country migrating into Canada, 75% of these people choose three locations, essentially Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver. Probably because these three are our largest cities. These are the cities that people know about. So they come, they choose these cities. But what you need to remember is that these international migrants do not necessarily stay where they first land. They come to Canada, they come to these three cities, which, as I said, are the three cities that are most well known for outsiders. So they come to these three, then they take a look around. They come to Canada, they see what's going on in the various provinces and the various big cities, and then realize that, oops, maybe I would be better off moving there or moving there or moving there. So that is why, in our case, it's not just a question of making yourself appealing to international migrant, but you have to keep in mind that these people that come in from other countries eventually move inside the country. And that is when, for example, a city like Calgary, in the province of Alberta, does not necessarily attract a whole lot of international migrant per se. So people don't come from other country to move to Calgary. But when you take a look at people coming from other countries in terms of their second move, if I may call it that, a lot of them are choosing Calgary as a destination. Mm-hmm. So because they're appealing, they've got a very sound economic outlook and very strong indicators on the health side and society and education. So all in all, it turns out to be a good thing to be attractive even to the people, not just international migrants.
And Calgary did very well in your rankings. But how much of that do you think is a result of the run-up in prices of the prices of natural resources?
Well, if we turn back the clock 20 years, I would tell you that, yeah, this economy is solely around oil and gas and the energy sector. But this economy is very nicely diversified. Now, if you want to start playing the chicken and egg question, you would probably be right in saying that energy is what triggered it all 20 years ago. But nowadays, when you take a look at the industrial composition of the Calgary economy, they have become very highly services sector oriented. So, of course, true, the original thing behind all of this was the energy sector. But today, this economy can survive an energy, let's say, crisis without wanting to use too big a word here. They would resist it much better than they would have, let's say, 20 years ago because of the diversification of their economy. But true, the fact that commodity prices are doing just fine is providing them with a very sound economic outlook. But I just want to say here that there's more to it than that now, and that they're much more diversified than they were, let's say, 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Did you, in your rankings, you attempted to measure performance on economy, health, society, housing, environment, innovation, and education on for each city. Did you weigh those things the same? Did you make the assumption that they all had the same impact on the attractiveness of cities?
It's such a great question, because I think that now that we're talking about the innovation domain, I think what's really innovative about this study is that we've asked ourselves the exact same question. Can we really think that the innovation domain carries as much weight as the economy domain in people's decision to move from one place to the other? And the question is no. And we've done a battery of empirical testing around that, testing for different sets of weight. And ultimately, we have actually let the computer tell us what was the optimal weight in order to maximize the correlation between our ranking of attractiveness and the actual migration figures. And as it turns out, the economy got the larger weight, which is not really surprising. But what we really liked about all of this is that all the seven domains which we thought mattered still matter to a lesser extent from one to the other. That much is true. As I said, the economy getting the top ranking. But then you start looking at things like the society indicators, things like crime, as I was saying earlier. It does matter, most definitely. Then you take a look at the health indicators. When I was suggesting that people are doing their homework now, people do worry about will there be enough general physicians in this new city that I'm thinking about moving to? Will there be enough specialist physicians in this new city I'm thinking of? So these are all questions that people are considering. And yes, it carries a little bit less weight than the economy, but at the end of the day, it does matter more and more. Environment is also getting more and more of a stronger result. And I can say that because we've tested different years, because this is the first issue. So I cannot tell you, compared to the last issue, whether this domain is now carrying more of a weight. But we did run some tests, computing results from 5-10 years ago. And I can tell you that 5-10 years ago, environment would have gotten nothing as a result. And now, oops, people are worried about that. Access to recycling, number of, what are some of the indicators here? Domestic water usage, the days under hair quality advisory. So people do look into these things. It does not carry anywhere near the same weight as the economy, but still, it does carry a bit of a weight, and it's not a surprising result because now people more and more are concerned about the environment, and it's another statistics that go into their decision process. But you're right. These domains do not deserve the same weight, and I think that this study really is at the vanguard in that respect, in that it's the first empirical attempt that I've seen of trying to measure the weight that each of these domain gets in terms of the people's decision process of moving from one location to another.
In the U.S., the most mobile part of the population clearly is actually 25 to 30-year-olds, and then 30 to 34 would be the next most mobile group. And it's very hard for me to believe that 25, 27, 28-year-olds are the least bit concerned about health and the number of specialty physicians, the number of general physicians. I mean, it's just not – they're healthy, right? I mean, that's why they don't buy health insurance. If you have a system that allows them to opt out, they do because, you know, they're healthy. They don't think about it. And I'm really curious as to again, if you're looking at the attractiveness of cities to a mobile population, how that sort of and again, you said that this study was not necessarily to try to understand which parts of the population were most mobile, but it seems like that would matter in terms of what you measure. I'm missing something here.
No, I'm totally agreeing with you, and that is why we tried to have a variety of indicators. And while you're right that 25-year-old may not be that interested in specialist physician, they may want to take a look into infant mortality, because you're talking about people that are 25, 26, 27, 28 that are probably thinking about getting a family not so far down the road. And infant mortality is one of the indicators that we have. So we try.
Which, of course, is highly correlated to poverty. So if I'm not, you know, if I'm poor, I'm probably not moving anyway. And if I've got a professional job, I'm probably not thinking about infant mortality, because I think it probably applies. It's a problem of that someone else has to deal with. Not that that's right or ethical, but simply, you know, it's a self-interested point of view, which most of us are indeed self-interested. So, you know, do you really think they're looking at infant mortality?
No, but, well, not necessarily all of them, but some of them might. It's some of the things that we've seen. Some people were telling me that, you know, because you can look at all these 46 indicators and say that, do you really mean to tell me that people worry so much about the temperature in their movement from one place to another? Well, okay, some people might not, but some people do. So it's hard to pick 46 indicators where you can guarantee that, yeah, everyone are looking at each and every one of those, but it's part of the things that we've heard or read and that we could incorporate into the final analysis. But at the end, I don't want to be too bogged down by that, in that at the end of the day, if, let's say, you talk about, let's say you want to question some of the indicators under the environment, environment does not carry a big weight in the end. So it's not as if you would alter significantly the overall result by taking one indicator out of the environment domain or replacing it by another, because environment does not carry a big weight. But at the end of the day, each of those indicators could be questioned. Some people could easily say, well, I certainly would not look into that. I don't think that most people would look into that. But then again, that is a debate that could be going on for a long, long time. Yeah. It's our first stab at this, and you know, will we be 5 years down the road having a different set of indicators? Sorry, it could be the case, but I think that for a first stab, we've asked around, we've consulted a lot of people, and I think at the end of the day, we were very pleased with the list of indicators we came up with.
Let me ask you this. You said you don't want people to remember this as a ranking, and yet you did rank cities. Tell me the top five cities on your list.
Well, the top five cities, if we stick to the Canadian ranking,
right,
is Calgary, as you mentioned, doing very well. And opposite to what too many people might think, it's not just because of their economy. They did well basically across every domain. Toronto, Vancouver, also ranked number two and three, mm-hmm, high up there. Edmonton, and then our first mid-sized city shows up, Victoria in British Columbia, at number five, and then closing the top six would be the national capital of Ottawa. Ottawa gets no, in fact, because we're talking about census metropolitan area, and Ottawa is gets no on that one. So they're closing the top six. Five of the top six cities then being among our larger city, the only large city that is not making it to the top. And it's not a surprising result even to people that live there and that have a big position there is Montreal. And the Montreal economy has been really, really hit hard on the manufacturing sector front, with a dollar appreciating by basically 40% over the past 4, 5, 6 years, meaning that our exports have been really challenged in terms of competitiveness. So for manufacturing, it's been a bit of a hard time, and Montreal has really taken a bit of a beating from that, and it hasn't made the city that attractive over the past few years, but I could see that turning around in a few years down the road.
Mm-hmm. You compared U.S. cities with Canadian cities using the same 46 indicators. How did U.S. cities stack up?
The biggest problem that we've had with our U.S. Canada-U.S. comparison, which is why we talked a little less about it, is that, yes, the original idea was to say, okay, we found 46 indicators, now let's compare U.S. cities with Canadian cities. And unfortunately, because of data definition, we had to drop 29 out of 46 because there were no perfect match in definition.
Ah.
And when you earn a living like I do in the world of municipal statistics, this is the biggest battle that you're always confronted with, and it's called data limitation.
Right.
So in this case here, we unfortunately had to settle with 17 indicators. What we like about it, though, is that at least we were able to get at least one indicator out of it for every domain. But the only thing that we really want to make out of our Canada-U.S. comparison, if I was to make a U.S. benchmarking, I would do it much more than 17, which is why I'm a bit reluctant to tell you whether it's true that Austin should be where it is relative to other U.S. cities. But to me, the big test here was to tell our Canadian cities, even those that do well, can we be complacent? That was the question that we wanted to answer. How many Canadian cities are making it to the top 10 once we include U.S. cities? Well, it's only two. It's Calgary and it's Edmonton. So that, to me, was the message that we wanted to send around to our Canadian cities, even to our best performers, in saying, okay, be careful here. You may have a great ranking when you compare yourself to other Canadian cities, but just remember here that this battle for immigrants, which to me is in its infancy, we have not seen the worst of this, because the aging of the population phenomenon is not a Canadian phenomenon. It's worldwide, and the battle for immigrant is not just between Calgary, Vancouver, and Montreal. It's between Calgary, Vancouver, Montreal, yes, but it's also against battling with U.S. cities and with Paris and with London, and you can name several industrialized country cities that will also be involved into this battle for trying to attract immigrant. So the message that we try to come up with here is, you know, let's try and put our act together on this before other countries do. We don't want to be reactive. Let's be proactive on this one. There's a big deal in this country about recognizing credentials. We need to tackle this very quickly. And this is not just a government thing. It's professional association that will have to step up to the plate. And we have to really do something better to our immigrants than just give them cabs to drive around. And at the end of the day, as I said, and at the risk of repeating myself, we strongly believe here at the Conference Board of Canada that the future prosperity of this country is through immigrants. And we have to make sure that we are as welcoming as possible.
Let me clarify one thing. You're talking about credentialing, and I'm sure you're talking about professional credentialing. In other words, do my professional credentials travel from my home country to Canada? So again, credentialing, accepting credentials, seems to be a federal problem. Now, tell me if I'm wrong. In other words, it seems that it would be very difficult to solve this problem or tackle it city by city, even though, as you say, it's not simply a government problem. Professional associations have to participate as well, and yet I would think most of those are, at least the credentialing part, is governed at, again, a federal level or a national level. So coming back to the purpose of your study, city magnets, What is it, do you think, cities can do to in this battle, can do and win in this battle for immigrants?
Well, I think that we actually have a couple of very concrete example of cities that have really taken the bull by the horn. And I'll name two. One of them is Winnipeg, and the other one, Winnipeg, which is located in the province of Manitoba, and Saskatoon, which is located in Saskatchewan. These two cities may not rank incredibly high if you take a look at our current ranking. I'm giving you this by memory, but I think Saskatoon is 13 and Winnipeg is 19, if I'm not mistaken, something like that. But I can assure you, because again, we digged out through the statistics, we looked at the past, if we conducted this study 5 or 10 years ago, they would have been much lower. And these two cities have been very aggressive in different ways. Winnipeg has been particularly aggressive in trying to put together in place, along with the provincial government of Manitoba, strategies around attracting international migrants. I'm not an expert at those strategies. I cannot tell you exactly what they were, but what I can tell you is that they've been successful, because when you take a look at Manitoba or Winnipeg population growth figures, 10 years ago, a good year in terms of population growth in Winnipeg was about 0.2, 0.3%. Now they're flirting with 1% per year in terms of population growth. So that's a tripling of the population growth rate over the course of about 10 years. So obviously, and it's all coming through international migration. So these policies have definitely been working. And in Saskatchewan, they're trying to attract former Saskatchewan residents that have moved on, because this province, historically speaking, have always lost people to other Canadian provinces. People would leave Saskatchewan thinking that the grass was greener in, be it Alberta or in Ontario or in British Columbia. Now they're being very aggressive, and they're really targeting former Saskatchewan residents, trying to get them back. And it's working again, because for the first time this year in 2007, well, this year, 2007 is already last year, sorry about that, for the first time in 2007, they had a positive net migration figure in Saskatchewan at the provincial level, meaning there were more people coming into Saskatchewan from other Canadian provinces than there were people from Saskatchewan leaving for other Canadian provinces. So obviously, again, this strategy seems to be working. So it's possible. That's a message that we've been telling our cities, because some cities that are low in our ranking have been calling us and saying, Mario, it's not that we do not agree with the ranking, it's not that we want to dispute it, but please tell us what do we do to get out of it, and what do we do to improve our thing. And again, I could not come up with concrete strategy, but I could definitely give them concrete examples of cities that have put their act together, that have really decided to be proactive about this, and that are now showing much stronger result in terms of population growth. And I think it's these are two particularly nice stories to tell.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for discussing city magnets with us, and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mario Lefebvre was project director of City Magnets, benchmarking the attractiveness of Canada's CMAs. After a short break, we'll find out how a group of Middle Tennesseans put together an unlikely coalition for an unlikely cause, smart growth. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Dr. Bridget Jones is Executive Director of Cumberland Region Tomorrow, an economic and community development and higher education professional. She has led major regional and community-level programs and projects in the Middle Tennessee area. Bridget, tell me about the work of Cumberland Region Tomorrow.
We are a nonprofit organization that was established in 2000 by an amazing group of leaders in our region, and Vanderbilt University birthed us, if you will, to work in partnership with the local governments, regional organizations, state governments, and more importantly, the private sector to try to create a framework where we could be more proactive in our growth planning that would lead us to more quality growth patterns and sustainable development. So we're a 501c3. We have a board of about 50 amazing leaders from our 10-county region. We do approach this from a regional basis. But we are a multiple constituency group, if you will, kind of business-led, citizen-led, that's here to partner with these other groups to encourage growth planning, with an emphasis on ensuring our future livability and economic vitality.
What was the impetus? Was there an event that triggered the need for this organization? Did something dramatic happen, or are these just people who came together and said the timing's right and we need to do this?
Well, there was something really special going on in Nashville around 2000. There were several key regional organizations birthed at that time. The Civic Design Center that you know very well in Nashville was formed. Partnership 2010, our regional economic development group, was formed. Leadership Middle Tennessee, which is a regional leadership program I'm a graduate of, was formed. And then CRT was formed. So there was a group of thinkers that were looking at the needs of the region and put in place some amazing organizations. And I'll talk more about that later, how we work with them. But the real reason for CRT really goes back to the early 80s when our region started realizing success in locating automobile manufacturers. Nissan came to Rutherford County in the early 80s, and then Saturn came to northern Murray County, where I live, in the mid-80s, and that was amazing economic progress for us. But the development patterns that emulated from that were, you know, as you would expect, the rules were set more for dispersed development sprawl. So, you know, everybody had to have a place to live. The economy started growing. And we were able to see by the mid-90s the effects of that in the amount of land consumed and traffic and all the things that go along with this. And then the other big event that catalyzed the formation of our organization were plans to create a new regional interstate loop all around Nashville, mm-hmm. that would actually mimic the big loop in Atlanta. So people, again, that was done in the thought of encouraging economic progress, and it has, and it will. But the realization that there were not really good land use plans or controls in place for the development that was sure to come really got a lot of people going and started looking at this region, this 9 or 10 county region, and the effect of that major transportation investment on future land use. And again, some way to address that was needed. The group that founded us looked at the Bluegrass Tomorrow model in Lexington, Kentucky. They also looked at Envision Utah. They looked around the country. And, you know, in 2000, Envision Utah and Bluegrass Tomorrow was already in business working regionally on these same issues. So, again, the other thing that really catalyzed the formation of us, Neil Pierce with the city-state groups came in. Vanderbilt raised the funding and hosted him along with Mr. Siegenthaler at the Tennessean. But they did a study called the Pierce Report that was the first hard critical look at the growth and development we'd seen in the 80s and 90s. And it was published, I think, in 99. Vanderbilt hosted a big regional summit to hear about, you know, a definition of the growth patterns that I have talked about. And they brought in a lot of huge nationally known speakers to talk about this. And we have on our website that report. But it really framed and defined what had happened and started at the region thinking maybe we need to be a little more proactive in the future. And actually at a regional planning summit in late 99, it was decided by unanimous vote to create this nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, does the region, the Cumberland region, completely mirror the Nashville metro area?
We have all the MSA counties in the Nashville MSA. But really, our 10 counties, I think the founders did a really good job. They identified these 10 counties, which are the economic commuter shed of our Middle Tennessee region. These 10 counties are the fastest growing ones in the state. You know, where Nashville is Expansion Magazine's hottest city, but it's really our region. So they looked at kind of the economic base and the economic realities. But to answer your question, we have the Nashville MSA counties. We have Clarksville that's an MSA. And then we have some other counties in between. But the data, the commuter data, who lives here, who works here, that sort of thing really shores up. And then recent economic research that was done by the University of Tennessee kind of solidified that decision. And
so it's bigger than the – it's actually bigger than the metro area.
Yeah, and then that makes it challenging because we have different – transportation planning groups that work in those different mm-hmm. areas, but mm-hmm. they're all willing and ready, I think, to start working together too. So this smart growth stuff, this quality growth stuff is complex, as you know, but the first step is just to create a base of information to know what you're dealing with and then create a relationship network and build enough knowledge and will to get people to come together to proactively address it.
You've noted that unlike metropolitan areas like Atlanta, like Chicago, most of the 34 cities and 20 towns of what you've defined as the Cumberland region are physically separate. So how do you get them to work together?
Very carefully. No, actually, my predecessor, Ed Cole, who now directs planning and environment at TDOT, really, and our board really is the foundation because there was a lot of care taken in picking out just the right leaders from each of our 10 counties to join our board. And I'm still amazed every day with the amazing group of people I get to work with. But these people, when I came to work 4.5 years ago, I realized they were amazing. They were very well positioned. They were committed to their communities in the region. And they understood the mechanics of smart growth. So I thought, wow, with a group like this, we can do something amazing. But that board and our founders and some other key organizations, our regional development district, other key organizations have brought together a relationship network through our board and also through the Greater Nashville Regional Council of all the elected officials. And CRT actually convenes these groups on a regular basis. You know, we have relationships with each of them, but we convene them as groups to talk about what their needs are related to growth and development. We stay in our niche. But it's just it's a very opportune time in our region because all of the folks that we interact with from the 10 counties that are in leadership roles and also lots of the people at the state level are really have been a part of the creation of our work, and now they're all kind of positioned in roles where they can say, hey, let's try to work on this. So
That's the good news side of this. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges of working at regional scale?
There are about three, and it goes back to the reality of the world. It's politics and money. Politically, still in Tennessee, the county seats were set up where they were one day's horseback ride from Nashville, okay? In my region. Mm-hmm. So we've got this ring of counties that a long time ago they were far apart. We've got a network of pikes that go out to all of them. But now with our interstates, it's only 30 minutes or 45 at the most to any county in my region. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we're close together. People don't know if they don't, the people here don't realize they work in one county, live somewhere else, shop somewhere else, but we've still got these old political boundaries in our minds. And frankly, they have jurisdiction over all the planning and zoning and, you know, the government regulatory framework for growth. So the political boundaries really are framed for all those municipalities and counties to operate individually. So that's a challenge. You know, I've got some towns or counties that have 9 or 10 towns that we're working in. But they have to work together and decide that, you know, it's in their best interest to address growth planning and to make decisions about their future, to work this together. And we're realizing some success through some amazing leadership at the local level.
Well, so, let me ask you something. Bridget, what makes it in their best interest?
Well, that's the second reason for the challenge, but it's also their best interest. The fiscal realities of the growth patterns that we've created with our set of rules that are in place are challenging. I mean, we've got Rutherford County in our region that has been building 1.5 schools per year for the last 10 or 12 years.
Wow.
You know, and the fiscal realities of that, and they have a high per capita income. They have balanced their you know, property rates and all that stuff to a point where they're managing it. But I've got other counties in the region that are pretty well set economically, but they're thinking, how in the world are we going to afford to do that? So the other challenge to this is just the fiscal reality. First of all, Tennessee, local governments make money through property taxes and sales tax. We don't have an income tax, which is a good thing. But so there's this competition always for, you know, jobs and rooftops and shopping centers that create a mechanism for the local governments to raise revenue to operate. And then, of course, the economic development people get into that, too, because they're, you know, kind of after building their own economies. So we've got this political or fiscal reality that we work with. But on the flip side, the way that's in everybody's best interest is building roads, widening interstates, now looking at regional water supply. Those county lines and those government jurisdictions, those problems are bigger than any one of those governments can solve. And we're now realizing in our region to have a regional transit system, mobility system, it's going to take all the counties working that together.
Are you working on a regional transit system?
Actually, there are some groups that have been organized just recently in Nashville. I am staffing Nashville's Agendas group on regionalism that by my co-chair, DeWitt Azell, who's the head of Bell South Tennessee, is chairing. And we're just trying to look at all these organizations I mentioned and figure out how we can all start working more closely together, you know, to start thinking and acting regionally. I mean, I've got the MPO in that mix. We have a regional transportation authority, you know, those kind of groups. So we're working on that. And then there's another sister team that's looking on regional transportation. And we've met with them. You know, we understand that, you know, they're interested in trying to figure out how to call for support, advocate some planning for regional transportation, or I like to say mobility. So, yeah, and the economic development people, our Partnership 2010 group I mentioned, is very successful, you know, and companies are coming to us now. But this traffic congestion thing and the delay in moving workers and goods is part of the realization that, you know, we need to look at transit for our future economic vitality. I had an article float across my desk yesterday from Smart Growth America, not picking on Atlanta, but, you know, talking about their congestion problems were beginning to affect employers' decisions on if they would locate down there or where to locate because of the inability to get their workers to work and or, you know, to get their goods and services there. So, you know, again, back to the economics of this, the fiscal realities of this are even, and we are, you know, here's the deal. If you're going to affect government change, it's very helpful to have a lot of people in the private sector or in other leadership groups to get together to work and support government to make these changes. And that's really the role of CRT in partnership with some of our other partner agencies to try to give our local governments and our state and regional groups support and a call to start approaching these things at a little bit more regional, higher level.
Let me ask you this. How simple can you make it to get to what you call quality growth? I guess you probably define quality growth very similarly to smart growth.
Right.
How simple can you make it?
The regulatory framework and the market incentives and just people's expectation that we have in place in our region, that are pretty much the same across the country, are creating the development patterns that we're seeing. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you want a different output from a system, you have to change or update the system. So the work we're doing to try to focus in on the government side of this, to encourage the development of comprehensive plans, and then to encourage the realignment of their zoning codes and subdivision regs, and encouraging them to use design guidelines in there, and to tie their infrastructure investments to that, is a way to be more proactive in framing the growth patterns that are going to happen.
Right. Who resists that?
Small town developers will resist it, because they kind of know they know what the rules are now, and they kind of know how to work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Citizens sometimes resist it because they don't understand, some of these new development types and, more new urbanistic things. They're afraid of density. So we've got to educate and show them examples of really great developments that would enhance their community instead of, make it bad. So, again, it goes back in both of those groups' case to being comfortable with what they know now.
Right.
But, if we can learn and teach people and show people how we can do this differently, and it will make their communities even better and make their property right, their values even better, and actually give the development community a broader array of development choices to build. Infield redevelopment is just amazing right now in Nashville, as it is in a lot of the cities that you cover. It's very exciting. And all of our towns in the region are working on their downtowns. We've got a lot of reinvestment going on, revitalization going on. But, just to level out the playing field where that sort of development and redevelopment is possible.
And how do you make and leveling the playing field and making good development and infill development possible is clearly critical. Are you also working with sticks? Are you also working to make undesirable development impossible?
Not at this time. Our board decided that we still had to really learn more about how to implement or change the system. So we were, when 2000, I already talked about the care that was given in organizing our group. And then the first phase of our work, this is all on our website, was a 3-year research phase that defined how much the area was going to grow. We have maps that show a big sprawl base case or an alternative smart growth, quality growth case. And we were able to compare the differences and compare economically the difference between those. So then you've got a base of information to operate on. Okay. And then we started to introduce smart growth strategies. A little bit broader than that now with quality growth, what we've done. But so we started to inform and educate at that time about the choices. And then strategically in 2004 and 2005, we decided that, part of our role is to lead the discussion on quality growth. But we also wanted to move into a phase where we started developing tools and resources to help our communities implement it. So we pulled together 150 people from our region. We hired national consultants. We created a training and technical assistance program. It's called our Quality Growth Toolbox, that we're out now in the region teaching people how to do elements of smart growth or quality growth. Because if people don't understand this, they can't believe it.
Dr. Bridget Jones is Executive Director of Cumberland Region Tomorrow. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith talks about his perspective on geography.
I'm on a plane nearly every day to meet with clients located all over the country. Over the years, this experience has redefined my perspective on distance, space, and geography. For me, Seattle is no farther away than Charleston, South Carolina. Both are 5 hours, because usually I drive to Charleston from Atlanta. In fact, Seattle is an easier trip for me. I'm just a passenger to Seattle, so I can make the trip back and forth in one day, whereas I'm the driver to Charleston, so that requires rest overnight. I used to joke to my wife at night that I had just spent the day in my office in New York, or Chicago, or St. Louis, or Denver, or wherever. My commute often entails drastic changes in weather and sometimes a change in time zones. But I no longer see Stamford, Connecticut, or Northbrook, Illinois, or Mountain View, California as far away. I can be in all three for a morning meeting and still get home the same day. But with this perspective on geography, I miss a lot. I am not grounded anywhere in particular. The places I see the most are the artificial environments of airports that have been erected to keep travelers from being inconvenienced or hassled by local climate and topography. From the air, I see a maze of highways, rivers, and rails that lead to clusters of buildings and cars that constitute cities and towns. But my feeling for the expanse of the country is governed by the fact that I am always flying over it, compressing distances and leapfrogging the terrain. To me, the world seems compact, with barriers easily hurdled. I do not live with a ground-level view. There is a Buddhist initiation ceremony known as the Kala Chakra, for which millions of pilgrims travel hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles. It is a 12-day ritual presided over by the Dalai Lama. Many arrive on foot, a walking journey in which each step must include a body-length prostration of oneself. A new documentary film called Wheel of Time, directed by the German film director Werner Herzog, provides a thoroughgoing view of the Kala Chakra held in Australia during 2002. One of the monks interviewed, who made much of the journey by foot, had touched the ground so many times with his forehead that it was injured. As a reviewer in the New York Times wrote, this monk, quote-unquote, declares ecstatically that this punishing ritual taught him the size of the earth. I do not know distance, space, and geography as this monk knows it, and so I cannot say that, like him, I know the size of the earth. But I do worry that it takes a ground-level view to live in concert with the land and thus ultimately with one another. Yet there are more and more people like me who know the earth only as a flyover space or as a virtual reality. We are losing our perspective and thus are more likely to have an overweening overestimation of just how big we really are. Time, perhaps, for a new ritual to teach us all the size of the earth. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. His new book is Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.